you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
You have entered the Twilight Histories, an audio adventure that casts you as the hero. You will travel to strange, exotic worlds in the multiverse. A Carthaginian base on Mars, Egypt locked in an ice age, a Roman Empire that never fell. With the help of music and sound effects, you will be immersed in worlds out of time. Today, you will explore a terrifying world of jungles and greed, of death and plunder. This is a story of an eternal war. There is a bonus story available to our Patreon supporters, and I'll play a sample of that at the end of the show. So don't change the channel once this is done. You're going to want to hear it. And now, for today's show, this is War by Tristan Verboven.
The jungle canopy sits heavy in its own damp treacle. Zoom out and you see a green lake swaying in the breeze, dashes of sunlight speckling the floor below. And zoom in to the crunchy leaves, soaking twigs, the musty soil of life. Tiny snakes and scorpions, maggots and creepers, mosses and molds, they wage a great battle. Armies and allies, trenches and raids, they dig deep. They are soldiers in the Forever War, a trillion pinheads to the inch. And with a single footstep, the battle is interrupted, but only for a moment. A passing trail, then back again to the onslaught. The women continue, unaware each time. They have traveled like this for days, following streams to low land, seeking out clearings, grassland, the perfect badlands, the great pitch battlefield. The older one, Sepulta, she knows they're here somewhere. But it's the younger one, Hethri, who has the eyes and fingers to find them. She scratches at mounds, shakes up tree trunks. They can smell them, hear them.
Now one of them be this. This now one of the warriors.
She plucks it up by the shell, letting it crawl across her knuckles. Sepulta's face lights up. Hethri drops it as it bites her wrist.
Tristan go house. We got finding queen.
Such a place is where you have chosen to visit. A ghastly place to any first-time visitor. Just the heat, the humidity, the pests, large and small. They're trying to kill you, and they don't even know you're there. The skipper lives in the front part of the boat with his family, and he knows the river well. The tiny putt-putt, just enough to gain on the downflow. The only sign of life is the boat's going the other way. Passenger barges at first, fishing boats, canoes, rafts. But these days all you see is barges loaded with bales, one after another, down to the capital, past a clerk, and then out to sea. And at night you sleep under a net. By morning it's crawling with insects. Every day the village churches get smaller. The natives get more painted. Some of them with spears and bows. Others wear trousers with rifles over their backs. You put your hand over the gunwale and into the water to scoop up the wake. The skipper clicks at you, cuts the motor, telling you to stay quiet. You yank your hand out fast. The boat glides into a grassy marsh, and he squats at the bow, reaching for his pike. Plunges it into a slithery creature, pulling it out by the skull. It wriggles on the metal point in a choke. Sejuan. It's the last town with a boat slip, says the skipper. You can find someone who speaks English. You can get a drink. Even mail a letter there. But other than that, it's a dock full of flies and mosquitoes. And after this, it's all settlers and jungle. Fister's place is still another 5 hours upriver. I'll take you there, he says. I'll be back in a few days. The narrow craft travels slower now, nimble, and the skipper keeps his pike near. This is what you signed up for. The experience of a colonial settler, just as Kipling describes it, bringing progress to the darkest reaches, the winding rivers, where the sun follows the plow. As you pull up, Fister appears, from behind the bales weighing down a barge like the ones you've seen for days. He strikes a dashing pose, a wide hat with salt stains around the rim, a white shirt with waistcoat, camo pants and ankle-length boots, finished with a foppish yellow kerchief around his neck. His two men carry the rifles. He wears a simple revolver in his belt. As you careen in, a dog comes galloping up barking. The Fister greets you warmly, ushering you off the rickety dock onto slippery terra firma. Sabado and Bigote, he introduces his companions. They are swarthy and unkempt, but not natives. Not European like Fister, either. And this is Raffi. The dog wags its tail frantically, sniffing your hand. They let you take the front seat in the jeep. Fister drives the whole way talking up the road, pointing out all the features. You're probably wondering how I got a jeep way out here with no roads. Or how I got any of this stuff here, for that matter. He pulls up in front of the compound. Out here in the middle of nowhere. He bangs the hood. Military surplus. The company bought it up, and now they contract it out. The old jeep looks pretty beat up. But it still has traces of its old markings. And the main house is a barracks prefab, with a few dozen oil drums stacked in a barbed wire perimeter. Everything else is burlap lean-tos and bivouacs, though they seem to have everything that you would need. Company airlifted it in, he boasts. Dropped it, right here. and me and my boys built it up. We're 3 years in, 7 more years to go. The story is that Pfister is no stranger to any of this military gear. He came over in the Colonial Force, Engineering Corps, and picked up a franchise with the company. The 10-year contract is simple and standard. They drop him upriver, and he sends bales downriver. And when the patch of land is spent, then he gets paid. Your room is in the back. An army cot, rough blankets. An ingenious hatch to the water tank above for washing. And his boys sleep in the tent by the supply hangar. It's got a generator, tools, a thresher, and more crates. Lunch is sea rations. Stenciled MREs marked beef stew and another one called peaches in brine. Pfister gives you a tour, taking the dog in the back, leaving the boys behind. A dirt track leads down the middle of the estate, 100 acres in all in a straight line from the river, cutting deep into the lush. The whole thing is fed by an irrigation trough winding back to the river. It's a startling sight. Straight lines, cash crop, industrial farming, sliced right into a jungle like an enormous gash. First it was slashed and burned, then cleared and plowed, and now finally it's sowing and reaping. And left in the hands of a man with his two helpers who patrol it against the creeping green and the savage beasts. "Everything cut by machete," he says. "Each harvest I bring in some locals from Sichuan. The children bend them into bales and the women carry them to the barges." He stops the jeep suddenly. Rafi is snarling. Pfister stands up scanning the tree line. He hands you the field glasses, pulling out his pistol. You see them. Two native men lurking at the fringe. They look back without expression. Faces darkened up past the cheeks, and bodies white muddied and glistening. You're startled by the gunshot, but they do not flinch. "Wish I had my rifle. Could have had a better shot." "Who are they?" you ask. "Ghosts," he chuckles. "They used to have their village here." Pfister looks again, but they've gone back into the bush. "I guess nobody told them that the company bought their land from the government." He snarls. "Probably don't even know they have a government." He puts his pistol back in the holster. "I'll tell you something, though," he says, starting the motor. "If they try to terrorize me, I will defend my right. This is my land now." Further down the road, Pfister stops to inspect the crop. You hop down into the neat rows, and the earth is crawling with red ants. "Don't mind them, they're mostly harmless." He swats at his knee, and Rafi stays in the jeep yelping at them. "Just don't let them up your pant leg." He gently turns the leaves over one by one. "See, they eat the aphids. These nasty little creatures. They're like little blobs. They'll rob you of your crop." He stands up again, resting his hand on his holster. "It's like everything's trying to kill something out here. And everything else is trying not to die." Rafi sniffs into the wind. "And that's the extent of it. It's all jungle after this." You head back now. It's getting dark. Not much more to do after dark around here but waste fuel and worry. There's no relief from the heat, no peace from the mosquitoes, and the dark alone will eat you alive. It's a world where everyone but you can see. Once the sun is down, the evening meal is eaten, and the boys have gone to their tent, Pfister invites you to a nightcap, pulling out a bottle of whiskey. "I don't know what brings you out here," he says frankly, "or what you're expecting to find here, or if you are disappointed by what you see. I just want to see what life is like on the fringes, I guess," you reply. "Maybe then, with your eyes, you see an awful place here," he pours a glass. "You see us invading the peace of this savage land, sending the people on their way, just for profit."
"Are you not here to make a profit?" you ask.
"Ha! You best believe I am." He straightens his back, raising his glass. "And bring progress to this place, prosperity to the families I give jobs to, and wealth, yes, wealth to the shareholders, and even some profit for myself."
"Ha! To profit," you say, raising your glass. And by a single bulb, you play cards until the bottle is done.
And tomorrow's light will bring our world again.
Pfister opens the prefab door with a creak. Bigotti's face is no joke.
"You want to see him, boss? Rafi, your dog. I don't know where she go."
All four of you in the Jeep this time. Before even having breakfast, Bigotti rides shotgun. Sabato holds his rifle on his lap. In the last field on the road, 3 miles from the compound, you all get out and walk through the stalks. It opens to an enormous barren patch. Just skeleton brush, parched soil, and scraps of stalk, and Raffi's partially decomposed remains in a heap. Brown dirt with flutes protruding like crude chimneys. It's eerily silent. The body is covered in flies, its bones nearly picked clean in patches of fur. Pfister stands nearby, looking at an enormous mound. Dried in the sun, a network of worn paths to it, but not an insect in sight. Bigotti shrugs.
"This one has something way bad. This one we never see him before."
Even the fire ants are gone. Pfister is quiet, and all the way back to the Jeep he says nothing, his gears turning in his head. "What was that?" you ask Sabato.
"This one's the night warriors. Kill us."
Back at the Jeep, Pfister takes out a map, and Sabato and Bigotti stand around it discussing the attack. The plan is to run a hose from the duct to spout in the top of the mound. The colony will get flushed out, the creatures will scatter, and Pfister seems confident that this will work. So the boys go along. They come back with a length of hose and a pump powered by the Jeep's winch, and they get to work pouring water down the spout into the mound. At first, nothing happens. For a few minutes, it takes on the water. Then the ground starts to grumble, and the water backs up, and the earth around the mound soaks to a darkened brown, and they cut the water off. "We'll see how it looks tomorrow," says Pfister. "See if they like to swim." "You think that's going to do it?" you ask. Bigote and Sabato do not seem convinced, but Pfister laughs. "Nothing modern technology and good old-fashioned ingenuity won't cure." He says this, but as soon as we're back at the compound, he goes to work unpacking supplies. Shovels and picks in the back, jerry can strapped to the hood, and electrical wire, large coils of it, rubber hose by the spool. And it takes two trips in the jeep, unloading the gear 200 yards from the mound. He hands us each a tool and orders a trench a foot deep straight across the field, slashing a path 2 meters wide on either side. By afternoon, we've managed a modest trough the width of the field, and Pfister runs a hose down it, attaching it to a jerry can. And then, all there is to do is wait. By night, when you take to your cot, he's still up, listening to the darkness, gazing into the void. By morning, every straw, stalk, and blade of grass on the other side of our trough is gone. Completely. Just dry earth where a crop once stood. And in the center of the empty field, a symbol of defiance. A mound, now enormous. A city of these creatures below the earth, waiting for the sun to fall again. Pfister steps out of the jeep, and he calmly unstraps a jerry can and hauls it over to the opening of the shaft. He pours some in, waiting for it to seep down. He pours some more, and so on until the entire can is empty. Pfister is ready to fight. He orders us to slash the crop on the other side, then place the crop as bait along the trough. "We'll burn them out. When they come for the bait, we'll burn the survivors." But he's not done. On a series of poles, he hangs a string of lights, fed by a generator ready to illuminate the entire length of the trough. "We can only kill them if we can see them," he laughs. "So, let the battle begin." As evening closes in, he watches over the line, checking it and rechecking it against breaches. And just as the sun creeps behind the trees, he steps out. Pulling a pack of matches from his pocket, he steps slowly and quietly towards the mound. Bigote and Sabato look on. He lights the match, letting it slowly take flame to the matchstick, then flicks it into the mound. The mound sits quiet. It is now a torch of flame. With crackling spits popping into the air, we all watch it go up. The towering pyre dances as the smoldering dusk sets, darkening the earth as we gaze down into the dazzling bonfire. And from it, a smell like no other. Almost like burning hair. It's pungent, sour smelling. This stench, it's intoxicating. At first unpleasant, and then a singularly enticing aroma. We are all taken by the soothing fragrance as we stare into the licking flames, conjuring images of earthly kingdoms, tingling bejeweled palaces, an empire of insects, crawling in splendid spirals, raising great towers into the sky, each one fizzling into a glorious dance, crackling in perfect harmony. And you feel an itching on the back of your neck. You notice Bigote patting down his pant legs and the others stomping furiously. "What the hell is going on?" you scream. Fister runs over to the generator, throwing the switch, and the field lights up. The earth that had been parched earlier is now alive. It crawls like its own pulsating blanket. It is devouring the bales placed as bait, pouring into the trough and scattering around our feet. You catch one crawling up your neck. A beetle an inch long, completely black, with pincers and a forked tail. It plunges its weapon into your flesh, causing you to snap it away, alerting more to attack your body in droves. And all you can do is swat furiously. "Get back!" shouts Fister. "I'm gonna light them up!" The trough fires up in a streak of flame, and for a moment a wall of fire separates you from the onslaught, sending thousands of crackling creatures into the sky, popping and falling like snowflakes. And when the flames go down to sputter on the ground, there's an eerie moment as the earth stops crawling, leaving only the sound of insects falling to the ground. And then the lights start to flicker. Sabato checks out the generator.
"Boss, this bad boy, they drew to the wire. Then the old body, please."
The field is thrown into darkness. Desperate, Fister sprays gasoline all over the ground, running the length of the ditch with his flashlight. The insects are all over us. They now crawl through our clothes, tangle in our hair. They hail down in charred remains. The jeep is swarming with them. You make your way back to the compound by foot, half limping, half shuffling, following the edge of the road in the darkness. And to fill the blackness around you, your mind summons a legion of demons and jungle monsters. The air around your ears fills with the symphony of the arcane, treacherous howls and flutters, cracks of twigs and whiff of predatory beasts, daring not to put your hands before you so as not to stir them. And by the time you get back, you're pretty sure you've shaken the last of the beasts from your clothes, washing yourself under the rainwater shower and plucking the last of them from your pockets and squashing them under your boot. You look back out at the fields. The darkness is broken by flashes of gasoline burn and the headlights of a jeep. And out there, Fister fights the battle alone, setting fire to entire fields, trying to keep the beetles from advancing. And all night, the valley smolders. It's another hour before dawn. Sabato and Bigote are gone. They have taken the barge with its final load of bales and gone downstream into the night, barely stopping to collect their things. And the jeep finally pulls up. Fister stumbles out, exhausted. His clothes charred and torn. His fingers shaking. He drinks to his thirst, bathing his head in water. He can barely stand, collapsing to his knees and weeping uncontrollably.
"That's the last of them," he says, raising himself slowly, making his way into the prefab, and collapsing in his chair. He pulls out a glass, carelessly filling it with whiskey, and he unholsters his weapon and places it on the table. I had to burn it all down, every last crop. His body sits broken. But I got them. I got them all right.
He looks at his hand still shaking. One of the critters is crawling around his knuckle. He smiles at it like a little pet.
How is it possible? He groans. A tiny little beetle. He can't even see with his tiny little brain. He doesn't even know he's at war.
He picks up his pistol and aims it at the thing.
Pow, 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 he jokes. Your boat will pick you up at dawn. So, best you make your way down to the dock.
He waves you gone.
You don't need to stay. This fight is over.
The bug bites him, and he watches relishing as his gruesome mandibles dig into his flesh. And then with his thumb, he crushes it into the back of his hand.
You see, it's so easy, he chuckles.
Just then, the lights in the prefab start to flicker.
Oh no!
He looks down and his legs are covered in the creatures, the chair crawling with them.
No!
Then darkness.
No! No! No!
You make your way to the dock in the dark, to the fading sounds of shouts, and then screams, or is it laughter? No, it's screams, all right. The screams of a man who has met his match, a general who has led modern hubris against an ancient warrior race, and lost. But you have spent enough time in this hell. Your fight is over. Just get back on the boat and let this place go its own way, back to its previous occupants. Go on then, let the soldiers fight their wars, and the tribesmen find their homes again. And the company calculate its returns and just chalk it all up to the fog of war.
That was War by Tristan Verboven. As I mentioned at the start of the show, there is a bonus story only available to our Patreon supporters. This one involves a rich businessman who wishes to meddle in history. He sends crates of AK-47s back in time to ancient Greece. Have a listen to this sample. You wake. The sky is bright. It stings your eyes. You try to cover them with your hands, but hit something metal. You're wearing a helmet. There's metal all over your face, except for two eye slits and a thin line down the center in front of your nose and mouth. You pull the helmet off and hold it above you, squinting your eyes against the glare. It slowly comes into focus. You've seen something like this before, in museums. It's an ancient helmet. Ancient Greek? Roman? No, it's Greek. But why were you wearing an ancient Greek helmet? You sit up. You feel a wave of dizziness and nausea. You shouldn't have sat up so fast. You notice your clothes are strange. You're wearing ancient Greek armor to match your helmet. You have a kilt and greaves, and you're wearing a sword. Through squinting eyes, you look at your surroundings. You're in a field. It's a scrappy field with new shoots rising from dry, cracked soil. There are wooden crates scattered around the field, the kind used for transporting goods. You lift yourself up with a wave of nausea and limp your way over to the nearest crate. It's tied down and ratcheted. You pull out your hoplite sword and cut the ties with a twang. You break open the lid using your sword like a crowbar. You rummage through the packing foam. You feel something hard and metallic. You pull it out. It's an AK-47. You check the curved magazine. It's full of ammo. Probably not the safest way to transport it. You sling the rifle over your shoulder. You see a woman in the field. You're startled and you instinctively duck behind the crate. Is she armed? You carefully look over the top of the crate. The woman is olive-skinned, and she has long, wild black hair. One of her eyes is... If you want to hear the rest of this story, as well as gain access to almost 200 other audio adventures only available to our supporters, please head on over to our Patreon page by looking up the Twilight Histories. You can also go to our website and follow the link to Patreon at twilighthistories.com. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thank you for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.